Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Soul Catching Cord by James W. Bennett and Sung Kwan Ling. Mo Qian should have lived in the days of Confucius, or tippled wine and made glorious lyrics to the moon with Li Tai Po, for he was one of those now fast-vanishing folk, relic of a medieval scholastic day, a Chinese scholar and mystic. His faded scarlet-rimmed eyes had peered into strange places, yet pieced together the legends on ancient stone tablets. He had muttered the talismanic words disclosed. Then he had watched the curtain of reality swing back. He had seen a forest of imploring arms raised toward him, asking to return from that shadowy world, the Western Paradise, the myriads who had tasted of the Yellow Springs. Early one evening he was returning to his home, a village not far from the city of Suzhou. The path was too narrow to admit a rickshaw, and he was walking feebly. The distance before him was still 10 li. A rack of clouds tumbled in a vast hurry across the sky like breakers on the shore when the typhoon rages, and something resembling a typhoon was brewing to the southwest. Lightning flashed with fitful petulance. Mo Qian gazed upward, not without trepidation. Old bones do not stand the buffeting of the water gods with impunity. The weather was unusual and unseasonable for the mid-autumn festival. This vaguely troubled Mo Qian. The moon goddess must be angry, since she was veiling her face during the time that men wished to worship her. With a howl, the storm suddenly broke, directly over his head, it seemed. The night dropped like a gigantic cloak, a clinging sable velvet stifling. Then rained sheet upon sheet of cold, stinging musketry fire. Mo Qian shaded his eyes and peered through the deluge. At first, he could make out nothing except that whirling gray blackness. Later, he thought he could discern a wavering cluster of lights. A li away, a momentary lull confirmed his observation. A tiny hamlet. Staggering beneath the screaming menace of wind and rain, he made for the home with the nearest light. And he neared the habitation, he stumbled over a grave mound and fell. He picked himself up with a groan. The brick wall of the mound seemed newly built. It had not crumbled and showered tile upon him. Reaching the house, he pounded on the door. But the typhoon song was deafening, a gargantuan roar. After a moment's hesitation, Mo Qian undid the latch and entered. The tiny open courtyard was empty. He pushed back under the eaves and philosophically sat himself down. With the passing of a half hour, the roar of the wind lessened, but the rain continued. At first he had thought the habitation empty, but now, with a partial cessation of sound, he could hear the murmur of voices directly at his back. He rose to knock again at this inner door. As he was scrambling to his feet, a woman's voice rang shrilly. "I saw you. You smiled at her. You ogled at her, a brazen hussy, her cheeks flaming scarlet with sin and paint." "But Mian An," came a man's worried reply. "I swear I..." His words were blanked by the torrent that poured forth. "I know. You would make her your small wife. Her feet are bound. Golden lilies, and she can do no labor. I will become your drudge and hers. You would have me do her bidding? Never. Rather than that, I would..." "Stop! You stress too much my smiling upon a sing-song girl." "Aye!" Then shriek after shriek echoed through the court, mingled with the dying obbligato of the storm. Mo Qian frowned, pausing with his hand lifted to knock and demand entrance. Then he shook his head. He dared not break into this family quarrel. He knew the symptoms here. A fit of qi, wrath matter, that queer oriental form of hysteria which so often attacked his countrymen. He had heard women screeching on their housetops for hours. He had seen men, under its influence, stagger sightlessly to an enemy's door and thrust a dagger into their own bosoms. And in China, to have men die on one's doorstep is a worse fate than death itself. The gods do not forgive the living. Chi. The woman's cries continued, the door opened, and Mo Chen hastily stepped back. A young man, little more than a boy in age, ran out, muttering, "The husband." Mo Chen leaned back and ruefully gazed out upon the storm, the steady downpour of rain. It was better to stay where he was, till the torrent slackened. With a slow crawling gait of time, the mournful wail of the woman changed to racking sobs. The air grew perceptibly colder and danker. The scholar shivered. There was a feeling in that courtyard as if the door of a crypt had been opened, a rush of wind long pent up with dusty bones. In a distant corner, a light appeared, a tiny point of flame. It flickered dimly for a moment, gave a desperate leap, and went out. The sobbing of the woman inside became dulled to catching quick-drawn inhalations of breath, but now, from the corner of the courtyard, whence had come the light, he heard a scratching sound, a pause, then a mewing and whining in one. An overmastering fear drove him to his feet and to the outer door of the house. Thick darkness was about him. Suddenly that grave mound was illuminated. Blue lights began to dance about its new-bricked walls. The sound inside was following him. He tried to console himself with the thought that he was an old man. If death were imminent, surely a place was prepared for him in that land of demigods who had once been scholars. The noise whirled round and round like a top in the brick-paved yard. It neared him, but as it did so, it ascended and gave place to the musical reverberation of 1,000 peachwood temple bells. At this, the grave mound, with a great detonation, burst asunder. Perhaps the roar was a thunderclap, for the fields an instant before had been suddenly ash-color, drenched in a great flood of lightning. Mo Chen threw up his hands and ran back into the court. There, all was still. A silence that pained his temples like the sharp prickle of 100 needles, then like the pressure of a gigantic vice, black. 10 minutes, perhaps, it was an hour of this, moved lethargically when the chuckle of a woman was heard. A senile chuckle, cracked and wavering. He gasped. That whirling sound had been filled with awful mystery, but this eerie laughter was appalling. Again that dancing cobalt light, it fused itself into the night, making the darkness transparent. The pupils of Mo Chen's eyes dilated. In the courtyard appeared a woman, old and dressed in somber black. Her face was pallid. Gold trinkets in her ears and hair glittered in that weird, unearthly light. Her step was soundless. She seemed to float rather than walk. Apparently, without seeing Mo Chen, she crossed the open space and entered the door at the left of the room in which the young wife was still sobbing. Curiosity overwhelmed the scholar. He followed and stood at that door. The room she had entered housed the family shrine, a small Buddha in red and gold lacquer. Before the image was a long carved table of teak. On this stood a pair of candlesticks, and in between them a bronze incense jar, a Yang Lu. The woman dropped upon her knees with seeming reverence. She kowtowed 3 times, touching her forehead to the stone flagging. Rising, she picked up the Yang Lu. Furtively, she took something from a pocket in her gown and tucked it under the jar, whose blackwood base offered room for concealment. Assuring herself that the object was concealed, she turned and vanished. The scholar rubbed his eyes. Gone. With her disappeared the cobalt light. Frowning, Mo Chen stood at the door. He wondered, debated, then decided to investigate. He felt his way cautiously into the room. He groped for the incense jar. The roughness of its bronze cover met his fingers. He reached underneath and felt something coiled, inanimate, cold, repulsive. He snatched up the object and thrust it into the pocket of his robe. Then he stopped and stood still in wonderment, for the thought was flooding over him with all the insistence of a mania that he must not part with that slippery coil. He must give up his life first, but he must never lose it. "Why do you look so downhearted, my child?" A voice came suddenly out of the adjacent chamber, the room of the young wife. The tone of the questioner was singularly hollow and feeble. "Why do you weep so bitterly?" "It's unfair of my husband," answered the young girl. "The flower bed of our marriage will be deserted." "He would take another wife?" Mo Chen recognized it as the voice of the old woman, who had chuckled. There was a moment of silence. Yes, and then my life will be a mockery. Death were preferable. Good, replied the old woman. It is fortunate for you that I am here. I am Vasan. I have the power to bring healing to bruised hearts, to give you sweet revenge on your unfaithful husband. Then give it to me. The old woman nodded. Inhale this current of fragrant air. The young wife sighed wonderingly. Now take that braided cord there, at the side of the brass-bound chest. Followed a rustling sound. Fasten it here to the beam above your head. Wait. Let me make a noose. Peep through it now. What do you see? The girl gave a hysterical laugh. What paradise is this? The light is glowing. It beckons. Have you been there? No, answered the old woman, rather unexpectedly, to Mo Chen, and he heard her whispering as if to herself, But I will be there this night. Another rustling movement. But we delay. Are you ready, my child? The scholar softly opened the door and peered in. From the ceiling fell a braided horsehair rope. Before it stood the young wife. She swayed slightly. Aye, lead on, Vasan. Ta-ta, I will follow. She draped a loop about her throat. Mo Chen's brain instantly sent out message after message, to interfere, to aid, to stop her, but his body refused to answer. Instead, he could only clasp that slippery coil, the tighter in his numbed fingers. He turned to the old woman. She was watching the movements of the girl with intense excitement and eagerness. Mo Chen felt her withered hands clenched and unclenched rapidly. Her eyes glittered like the cold fire of jewels. The wife was standing now on the brass-bound chest, the loop about her throat. Cat-like, the woman crept up on her. Flecks of foam stood at the corners of the withered, sagging mouth. The woman gave a low, triumphant cry and pushed violently against the girl. With a horrible snapping noise, the noose tautened. The small, unbound feet could not touch the floor. The young wife gasped once and was silent. Yeah, I've caught you. You are mine. Your body hangs now. Mine. Quick. I must go to the Yang Lu. There is the cord that will catch your soul and will ransom mine. Will ransom mine. For 3 years I have waited for this hour. Still muttering, the woman glided from the room. At the door she brushed near Mo Chen, but did not appear to see him. Once she had left the room, the blood seemed to flow again in his veins. The imperative messages now were answered. He rushed to the young woman and cut the cord. She sank limply at his feet. Already, her body appeared lifeless, his delay fatal. As he knelt over, he became conscious of twin points, dagger sharp, boring into his shoulders. The pain was excruciating. He turned. The old woman stood in the doorway, gazing at him. About her now was a nimbus of fiery orange light. A smile, half of fear, half of derision, played over her chalky features. For the first time, she seemed to be conscious of his presence. Mo Chen felt again that paralysis of mind and body creeping over him. She approached him gracefully, stretching forth a claw-like hand. She began, Please, give me back the cord. What cord? He mumbled evasively, his voice coming as if from a great distance. The cord I placed under the incense jar. What is it for? That is not for you to know. Give it back to me. The hollow voice vibrated with intensity. Why? Better you should not know, O mortal. Give it back to me, or I will... What? It was a tremendous effort to speak the monosyllable. I will force you to. Her voice rose shrilly. But the scholar shook his head doggedly. The effort drained heavily on his willpower. The woman gazed searchingly at his face and seemed dazed to find him firm. She took 3 steps toward him and flung up both her arms. Darkness instantly enveloped them, clammy, like the dripping death sweat of a tortured body in extremis, black. Minutes, deadly minutes of thick, cold blackness. Powers of evil, unseen, seemed to be struggling to reach him, his hand grasping that coil in his pocket, had lost all feeling, but the fingers were still curved around its braided surface. Finally, he felt a current of warm, perfumed air. Out of the darkness, slowly appeared the figure of a woman, young and ethereally lovely. She stood in a flood of rosy light, which seemed to emanate from her exquisitely tapering fingers. Hers was the beauty of milk-white jade, imperial and flawless. Her robe of shimmering white held on its surface golden dragons, dragons that seemed to move. Her face was bloodless, except for two pink spots on her cheeks, unchanging, as if some grisly farcer had dubbed carmine on the face of a corpse. Death blushing. Painfully, Mon Chien began to probe in his benumbed mind, back to the storehouses of his life, for words that warded off evil machinations, for phrases known to thrust back restless spirits into the world whence they had wandered. Once, even a few hours before, he had known such phrases, but now, to answer, none came. Her eyes beamed upon him, yet they showed no spirit of laughter. In her hands, she held a shining string of baubles. "Do you see this?" The scholar watched the play of iridescent light. "They are only the treasure of dead mollusks," he said. "But these pearls are more precious than that cord in your pocket. Give it to me, oh please. To you it is valueless, but to me?" And in a whisper, he heard the words, "The cord that will ransom my soul." The pain in his temple again. "No." "You can have this." She took a step toward him and offered a gleaming strand of pearls. "If you will give me back the cord." The voice came to Mo Chen, an echo syllabated by shadow. "No." "So, you refuse? Then bitter woe unto you." She took another step near him and exhaled a current of hideous black smoke. It surrounded him like a cloud. Instinctively, he closed his eyes and buried his nose and mouth in his sleeve. The smoke made his face tingle. "Will you give my cord back now?" she asked. "No," came his muffled answer from the folds of the sleeve. Again, he prodded his unwilling brain back along a path filled with dim-cut inscriptions and musty scrolls. Some one of those ancient archives contained foils for this malign necromancy, but still the answer eluded him. The sharp, prickling sensation of the smoke died away. He ventured to open his eyes. Blackness, again that blackness. Would the horror of it never cease? None of the fiendish arts of this woman preyed upon him like this. But this time Mo Chen did not have long to wait. Perhaps the old woman was too eager. A glow appeared before him. It was that now familiar cobalt flame, and the visage of the old specter. She took a step forward and frowned. With a leisurely movement, she grasped her own throat with both hands. They were like claws, those hands. He saw the tendons suddenly stand out. Behind them, the young wife stirred and moaned as some extreme of agony. Slowly the pressure appeared to deepen. The old woman's eyes began to bulge, as if they would come out of their sockets. A black, lengthening tongue was slowly forced between her teeth. Dark blood trickled from the corner of her mouth. Out of her throat came the gurgling plea. "The cord, oh, give!" Mo Chen raised his arm to stop that horrible self-strangulation. Something in the movement of his hand was a Chinese mystic's habit, to draw certain ancient characters in the air. By doing so, the scholar loosed their magic properties and made them potent. Something in that movement opened wide the floodgates of memory, and over the barren spillway came a score of answers from the canon of changes. Automatically, he chose the basic character. First, he drew with his finger a circle in the air. This represented Tai Chi, the great monad. He bisected the circle with an airy S-like line. Thus, he obtained the yang and the yin, the male and the female principles which began the process of evolution. This not only cut a clean division between man and woman, but also, more important, between day and night, between the world of substance and the realm that is of shadows. As he finished this, the diabolic woman tumbled back several paces. A look of fright came over her face. Mechanically, Mo Chen continued his diagram of the foundation character of this wondrous book of antiquity. The blue nimbus about the woman began to fade. Her features became more shadowy. Her hands dropped away from her throat. The young wife back of him ceased to groan. The air he breathed became less dank and cold. He bent forward over this drawing he was making. When again he looked up, he now discerned a bleached skeleton standing in a foggy light. The skeleton shook and swayed, clinging to its body in tatters. Backwards and forward it moved, like an inverted pendulum. The bony hands, raised to the skull, took it off and made a desperate attempt to hurl it at him. The skull clung to the blackened fingers as if magnetized. Before the scholar had completed the diagram, the skeleton fell to the ground. It moved feebly until darkness screened it from him. Then out of the night came a final, mournful and piteous cry. "Oh, spare me and give back the cord of my soul." As if in answer came the clear early morning call of a vendor of greens, the first always of the day. My shy sigh. The world of restless moving everyday life of reality was upon him. Overcome by a drowsiness that was almost a swoon, Mo Chen sank back with a groan and lost consciousness. His hand relaxed on the cold braided cord in his pocket. It was broad daylight when the scholar woke. As he opened his eyes, he saw a knot of people surrounding a young woman, the wife. They had picked her up from the floor where he had last seen her, and even now were loosening a heavy braided horsehair cord from around her neck. She was pale and her head lolled back. On her throat were great livid bruises. A young man, frightened and breathless, was chafing her hands. No one paid the least attention to Mo Chen. The girl wife showed no signs of life, and they carried her to the family hall, where stood the shrine. Her husband kowtowed before the god and burned silver and gold foil spirit money. He lighted 2 candles. At that moment, Mo Chen spoke wearily. "All that is unnecessary. She is not dead. Here, I have the cord that holds her soul." He felt in his pocket for the cold bit of braided rope, but the cord was gone. Yet in proof of his first statement, the wife stirred. She sighed and muttered, "Lead on, Bon San. Ta-ta, and I will not follow." The scholar completed her sentence with forcible distinctness. "What?" ejaculated an elderly man and neighbor. "This is more than strange. The old wife, Van Ta San, used to live here. Why, she died just before you were married. She hanged herself 3 years ago. Yes." The man became visibly more excited. "Yes, it was just 3 years ago last night. I remember because it was the 3rd day of the Mid-Autumn Festival. In that room, Mei An, in your bedroom." The young husband, now by his wife with tender remorsefulness, but gone from her were the shadowy vapors of qi. She smiled weakly back, and they both turned toward the old scholar, as if subconsciously aware that there, at their side, stood the deliverer. Before either of them could speak, he too smiled. His faded, far-seeing eyes were gentle. He picked up his traveler's staff and left the house. It was still some 10 li to his home, a village not far from the city of Suzhou. The Dark Interval by J.B. Powell. Hargrove thought, pray, why don't I pray? Can't. Never learned. Well, what's the difference? Why don't I get frightened? Whiskey. It's got me now. I've been a fool. Anne? Where's Anne? The will. Anne. The man was dying. At first, he had thought the attack was simply another spell with his heart. He had gotten up out of bed and poured himself a whiskey and soda, as was his habit when he had these sudden heart pains. He had then returned to bed to await relief and finally sleep. But the stimulant had failed, and as time went on, he felt his fat body grew limp and weak. The sharp pains crept nearer to his heart, and his brain felt numb and tired. He had checked an impulse to ring for a servant. He knew he was dying beyond aid, and he wanted no hysterical old man tottering about the room and wringing his useless hands. He had thought it strange that one should feel the approach of death so definitely and so calmly. He sometimes wondered just what the sensation would be like. He had wondered if those who lead so-called blameless lives would die more easily than men of his own type. He decided not. Funny, no regrets, no fright, no desire to hang on to life. Strange, too, that one could face the unknown so fearlessly when the time came. Well, he had gotten more of life than most people. He had lived. Death was a promise, he had thought. A promise of release, of rest, but only a promise. He had tried to turn this last thought over in his mind, but he felt his senses blurring, and his thoughts became vague and disconnected. And then Anne. He tried to call her, but the words froze on his cold lips. John Hargrove was dead. "Will you be going in right away, ma'am?" "Please, Mary. I kind of looked for you yesterday, but I guess you were so far away and everything." "Yes, Mary." "They put him in the big room. I thought it would be best with all his friends and all. I've been keeping the door locked against his relations and such. They come yesterday. I wanted to wait till you got here, ma'am. He's been in there 2 days now." The servant unlocked a pair of large oak doors, and the two women stepped into the darkened room. "Them candles are burning low again. I've been keeping them lit, but seems like they burned down mighty quick. He's over there by the grate, ma'am." The women stopped suddenly and peered down into the black coffin. "Looks natural, don't he, ma'am? Did he suffer, Mary?" "Went too quick to suffer, ma'am. Died in bed. Heart trouble takes him that way. Liquor, the doctor said. Guess he drank pretty much after you went, ma'am." Neither spoke for some minutes. The figure in the coffin fascinated them. Their eyes remained fixed upon the massive face, a face which might have been molded out of soft putty. The small eyes were closed, but the heavy jowl drew them downward and revealed slits of pale blue. The wide chin was creased twice and seemed to roll down below the stiff white collar. The servant broke the silence. "Perhaps I'd better get you a bite to eat, ma'am. A warm cup of tea would do you good." "No, Mary. Just take my things up. I'll be out presently." The door swung silently shut behind the servant. The woman, who remained, gazed quietly down upon her husband. Only one candle now remained lighted. It cast a pale yellow light into the face of the dead man. At length the woman lifted her eyes and glanced about her. The large room was dark and still. She could just discern the outlines of familiar objects. A chair, a table, a picture. She lowered her eyes once more and studied the expressionless face below her. She thought, "Death is stronger than love. Death has made him meek and still. Love only gave him the power to hurt, to crush. I don't hate him anymore. I simply pity him." The lone candle sputtered and went out. The white face in the coffin was the only object that could be seen in the black room. Mrs. Hargrove did not move. She continued to watch the face of thinking. Anne. Mrs. Hargrove whirled about. The voice came from behind. She had heard no one enter. The room was dark. Anne. The will. Anne. It was a man's voice, deep and solemn. It sounded like her husband's voice. She turned back to the coffin. Anne. No, it came from behind, but it was John's voice. "Yes, John," she said softly. A shaft of light crossed the room. "Are you all right, ma'am? I thought maybe you took sick being in there so long." The servant switched the lights on as she talked. "Yes, Mary, I'm quite all right," replied Mrs. Hargrove calmly. It seemed to Hargrove that he had been asleep an unusually long time. The sun was already streaming through the open windows as he leisurely rose from his bed. 10 o'clock at least, he thought. He turned mechanically toward a small table that contained his whiskey siphon, and he moved slowly toward it. He reached for a glass, but his hand seemed unable to close upon it. In fact, he thought his hand went right through it, as if it were a shadow. Somewhat dismayed, he turned and walked back to his bed. He decided that he was very sleepy, or perhaps still under the influence. He sat down on the edge of the bed and thoughtfully placed his head in his two hands. Finally, he stood up again, convinced that he was neither asleep nor drunk. He glanced down at the foot of the bed for his bathrobe. He would bathe and get dressed. Then he would feel better. His eyes fell upon the fat figure stretched out beside him, and he remembered then that it was dead. With the realization of death came intense misery. Hargrove had never felt its equal in life. It was not physical discomfort, nor was it quite mental agony. It was worse than either of them, but not so tangible. Comparing the feeling to life, it was, he thought, as if he had murdered everyone in the world, and was consequently forced to live alone. Alone? He thought, with a strict Puritan conscience for company. He felt utterly abandoned, and he was all misery. In life, he might have thrown off even so intense a suffering by drink or by any form of material pleasure. But in his present state, he was helpless. The persistent spiritual aching soon drove him into panic. He felt he must go somewhere, talk to someone, anyone. He wondered if he must remain in the bedroom with his useless body, and soon found that he could move through the solid objects, but that he could not leave the floor. He realized that he was invisible because no part of his being was visible to himself. He thought it strange that he could walk, although he seemed to drift along rather than take actual steps. But such misery! Every pang said, Anne, Anne. It was as if Anne herself were prodding his wounded soul, persecuting him with pain. He tried to think of other things, of pleasant things, but the voice said, Anne, with added distress, with unbearable wretchedness. Decided he could bear it no longer, Hargrove left the bedroom and went downstairs. The servants were in the kitchen eating breakfast. Undoubtedly, they had not yet discovered his body, and they knew better than to disturb him before noon. He decided not to bother them. He would walk out and try to find relief from this insufferable agony. He left the house and drifted aimlessly along familiar streets. He encountered several acquaintances, stopped, and bade them good morning, but they passed through him unperturbed. He shouted after them, but they paid him no heed. His misery increased. He could not understand if his present state were death, why life was so near at hand. And since life was so close, why could he not reach out and grasp it? He wondered if he must go on thus eternally. Where was the promise death had pledged him? Drifting, drifting. He who had been so completely material now, so entirely spiritual. Thoughts? He could do nothing but think back on Anne. Think back with a pang of remorse over each sordid detail of his life with her. He who had been so unutterably unfeeling, so thoroughly selfish. Think back, always back. No future, no ray of hope, no merciful rest. He must continue drifting, always drifting, drifting. He lived again his lurid years with his wife. He saw her young, attractive, an orphan depending on the world of men for her livelihood. She had been his secretary, and he had wanted her. And because she was honest, he had married her. But although she did become his wife, she was simply another woman in his life. That she had loved him mattered not. It was the same old hackneyed story of the man grown tired of the woman, and the woman dying a little from each rebuke, dying that slow, creeping death which only a woman who loves knows. And when finally she left him, he had thought it a great joke. He had hastened to his lawyer so that he might exclude her from any share of his worldly goods in case he died first. She had worked before. She could work now and continue to work until she cursed the day she left him. Just the same old trite story. Beauty and the Beast, that same old bromide. Work to death, a drug on the market, Beauty and the Beast. Hargrove lost track of all time in his suffering. How long he had drifted thus musing he knew not. At night he returned to his house through habit and spent the long night pacing the rooms. He would wander into the drawing room at times and stand before his coffin, vainly yearning that he might crawl back into his dead body and breathe again. Then he would enter the bedrooms where his relatives were quartered, seeking comfort there. He could hear them laughingly discussing his death. How much would they get? Already they were eager, planning to have the will read immediately after his funeral. Yes, they would get it. His dear relatives, every penny of it. His sweet relatives. And then back into the drawing room again, to pace the deep carpet by his coffin until Anne came. He felt satisfied that she would come. Death has strange drawing powers. It draws forgotten wives back to forgetting husbands. He was not startled when he heard the key turn in the lock and saw the door swing open. Of course, it would be Anne. He swooped forward to meet her and called her name frantically. He called again, again, no response. The servant, would she never go? Again, again. Oh, the servant was going now, gone. Again. She heard him, answered him. Tell her. Tell her something. What? The will, yes, the will. The servant again. Both going now, both gone. He followed his wife to her room and called to her all night in vain. It was a coincidence that John Hargrove's will was to be read in the same room where he had been buried. He thought of this as he watched his eager cousins file in and choose their seats. He noticed the anxious greed in their faces and cursed himself. His wife was dry-eyed and calm, sat apart from the group, quietly conversing with the attorney. The large room was no longer dark and somber. Cheerful flames shot from the log fireplace, and the late October sun flooded the room with brightness. The flowers which had yesterday graced his coffin had been removed. Even the gorgeous candelabrum had been hidden from sight. Hargrove marveled at the change death had worked in his heart. He wished Anne could know him now. He wished she might feel the deep love in his heart and know the gentle thoughtfulness that had enveloped him. Too late. All things come too late. He felt that he could atone for every wrong he had ever done her. Now. Yes, now. His intense misery had given way to more quiet pain. He felt that he was soon to die another death. The small leather case which the lawyer so carelessly tossed upon the table held poverty for Anne, and eternal suffering for him. It held a scrap of paper with the ravings of a madman scribbled on it, yet with the power to destroy two lives, a living one and a dead one. A sense of rebellion surged through him when the lawyer quietly opened his briefcase and extracted the document. He paced the floor frantically. The paper must not be read. No, no, he shouted. The attorney had already begun. I, John Hargrove, being of good health and sound mind, do hereby. Hargrove swooped forward and flung himself desperately upon the man. The paper slid gracelessly from the hands and fluttered slowly down into the fireplace. An over-anxious cousin brought out a single charred edge and a burnt hand for his pains. All eyes were riveted upon the lawyer. Hargrove's relatives were trying to digest what had just happened. A fortune had been burned before their very eyes. The attorney smiled, not sadly. The accident was unfortunate, he said blandly. According to the law of this state regarding lost and destroyed wills, the entire property, both real and personal, descends to John Hargrove's wife, Mrs. Anne Hargrove. With the attorney's last words, Hargrove felt himself lifted up out of the open window. He felt cool breezes play about him. The odor of fresh green fields came to him. Warm, friendly hands touched him. He heard soft, soothing music in the distance. His heart was light, and his soul was finally at rest.